the UN's credibility in trying to tell peacekeeping forces that they shouldn't violate women is totally undermined when the headquarters of the UN is allowing that same violation to occur within its midst. There has to be a systematic respect of these human rights across the board. And first of all, women have to demand that. Secondly, men have to stop covering up for other men and stop letting it go unnoticed, which is the kind of male bonding that goes on at the UN now.
Feminism and the United Nations on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Charlotte Bunch is a well-known feminist scholar and author. She's director of the Center for Women's Leadership at Rutgers University. Today, we hear some of Dr. Bunch's critique of the United Nations. She first gives us her thoughts on the barriers to women's overall participation in civil society and the cost society pays for this.
The barriers to women's participation in civil society in general are, first of all, the barriers that women face in their own homes that keep them out of the public sphere entirely. And I think that's both the responsibilities that women have in the homes, which is often so consuming that they don't have time for participation in civil society, particularly in many developing countries where women's workload in the home is simply overwhelming. Secondly, there are some specific cultural barriers that often apply in terms of women are either forbidden to go out at night often by family members. Even less extreme than, though, I mean, there are some, of course, women who are forbidden to leave their homes, period, by various either family members or cultural traditions. But even, say, even in the United States, where women can theoretically go out as much as they want, women's participation often in political events is also conditioned by how safe women feel in the public space at night. I mean, I certainly know, even in this country, women who say, well, I don't feel safe going out alone, so I didn't go to that event, that meeting, that place, or my child was sick, and so I stayed home, and, you know, it's much more often, although that's changing in a few places, when children are sick, when someone has to be taken care of, it's the woman who has to do that. All of these, whether it's directly, overtly, or indirectly, conditions make it impossible for many women to even reach the level of being able to be active politically at the local level, much less at the international level. I think at the international level, what you see happening is there is a sort of traditional assumption that women are about community and home matters. So women, if they start to be in civil society, still tend to be more at the local level, to be involved in issues that have to do with neighborhoods and communities. And when people start to talk about, the big issues of the global economy or peacemaking and disarmament, there's a sort of assumption that women don't know about those kinds of things. So when women run for office, say, in this country as well as in many parts of the world, as you move up to the national level, there's more and more assumption that women can't make those kinds of decisions, even where they may have been accepted at a more local level. So I think all of those are sort of barriers that affect women's ability to participate in civil society, especially globally.
And can, a little bit more about the cost of that?
Right. Yeah, the cost of that, I think, is, first of all, just the loss of the talents of half of the population who might have good ideas and bring experiences to that. But I think the more specific cost is that you really can't create solutions to problems when the experience of half the population of those problems is missing from the calculation. And I've used the example of Somalia as a case in point, where if you try to create peacekeeping, but you don't bring the women who are actually experiencing the process of holding the life and and the community together at the local level into the peacekeeping discussion, you don't get their insights, you don't get their perspectives, and you don't get ultimately their participation in how to keep the peace. And yet they are often the ones who are most engaged in the activities that might affect that in many ways. So your solution is built only on the perspective and experience of part of the population. And I think in that sense, you don't have a complete solution. You may miss many things that could be tried. You haven't, in a sense, legitimized the voices of people who might be able to really create and find new avenues and recourses.
In the international arena, we hear a lot of talk about the respect for culture and cultural diversity, but I've heard you point out that that's oftentimes a cover or an excuse for not talking about the oppression of women. Can you tell us something about that?
Yes, I think this is a really serious and difficult issue, because we do need respect for cultural diversity, and all cultures need to be seen as having good and bad things to contribute to the process of looking at what we're discussing as an international community. But I think the tendency to say that women and the family are just cultural issues is really a cover for what I call sometimes male bonding, in defense of the right of men to control women in their own cultures, and the right of men to decide how families and culture will be shaped. And that what we really have to do is to understand that we cannot have the price of the violation of the human rights of half the population in the name of culture, and that we need to see that women too are a part of that culture. If the culture has been completely defined, if who's saying what that culture wants is only half the population, is only the men in the culture, then we have to find a way for women to be able to voice what they want to see happen as well. And as many women have told me who come from third world countries, they have not been legitimized by the United Nations to speak about what it is that they want from their culture. And they want to keep some things, but they don't want to keep oppressive things. And so we have to take the lid off of that. And it's not to say that any of us should tell another culture what should happen, but we have to look more closely at who's defining for each group what it is that culture wants to be about.
And there's a certain amount of women's acceptance in this system also, or complicity?
Of course, there's definitely women's complicity. Some of that is, of course, women who have some power and prestige of their own within that culture, who benefit from maintaining control over other women. Certainly, this is a position that, say, mother-in-laws are often put in after being oppressed for many, many years as a wife, and then they become a mother-in-law and they sort of get a payback, so they maintain that oppression. I think that women need to have space to open up a dialogue amongst themselves about what it is they really want to keep happening and how they want to make that change, because sometimes women are complicit because they're bought off, sometimes they're complicit because they're silenced, and they fear for their lives if they speak out.
In the UN system, it seems that while women are slowly being allowed some voice in development or children's rights, we don't hear women's voices on traditional security issues, peacekeeping, or in the bigger international economic issues like the Bretton Woods, UN, ECOSOC coordination, those type of issues. Why not, and what can be done about that?
Well, it's interesting because in terms of the peace issues, there has been a very strong women's peace movement. And I think it's very peculiar that the women's peace movement hasn't been given more voice in the international disarmament and peacekeeping discussions. And I think that's a real example of where it's sort of women are viewed as somehow being capable of leading kind of local opposition to war. But when it comes to the hardcore of figuring out, you know, how to deal with weapons and defense and all the rest, we think women are too soft for that. And I've noticed that a lot more women are actually speaking on this issue, but there's been a gap between that voice and the international place. Now, in this whole series of world conferences, you'll notice that there hasn't been a world conference on peace per se. And I think it would be very interesting if we had a major conference on that in this period of time when women have begun to make clearer voices in the other topics, whether that would change. Likewise, on the global economy, I think there is a growing voice of women. I know we were involved with a number of women at the Social Summit in doing a hearing on how the Social Summit issues specifically impact on women, what is the gendered nature of the global economy. But that's new work that, I shouldn't say new, there's some women who've been doing that for years, but that work still hasn't broken through to being heard at the international level. But I think that work will. There certainly are women engaged in it. But the channels in those areas have been more closed to women, it's true.
Right. A couple more questions about the UN system. The first has to do with the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women. This position was created, or at least filled, last year. What will happen with that position now?
Well, the position, which is one of the main victories that women got from the World Conference on Human Rights, was created, as you said, last year. And the woman was appointed for 3 years. And her first year's report is really a general survey of the situation of violence against women. Now, there'll be two more reports in this three-year cycle where she will look more specifically at some of the issues of domestic violence and what states need to do around that and questions of women in war and conflict. It's my understanding that in another year, there will have to be a movement to get this position extended. What we will need to be showing the Human Rights Commission is that 3 years, you can barely begin to start an investigation. And I know that the current appointee is a woman from Sri Lanka.
And her name is?
Her name is Radhika Kumaraswamy. She's a feminist lawyer from Sri Lanka. And she wants to recommend that the position be extended for 3 years, whether she fills it or someone else takes the position, in order for the investigation of violence against women to expand to looking more at the causes and consequences, the structural nature of violence against women, and the way in which it's embedded in society. I hope that the Commission on Human Rights will extend it. I think they probably will. I think there'll be a lot of pressure on them to do so. Because once you start to look at violence against women, you see that, of course, this problem can barely be touched in a three-year period. And many, many, many rapporteurs in the UN are extended over a long period of time. There continues to be a rapporteur, for example, on torture, and has been for many, many years. So, because the problem of torture hasn't gone away, and I think that's probably going to be true with this one, the person can change, but the need for that institution should continue.
Another UN question. Expanding the Security Council has been a major topic. Yet, what I find interesting is that even if the Security Council is expanded, meaning more nation states get permanent seats or some new format for those seats is created, that doesn't necessarily guarantee that there will be any more diversity on the council or that we'll hear anything new from those people in those new seats. Have you thought about that concept?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this has been one of the dilemmas that women have felt in looking at this issue. Certainly in geopolitical terms, we understand why many countries want to expand the Security Council, and it probably needs to be done, but it doesn't in any way challenge it doesn't challenge the lack of diversity on the Security Council in terms of who represents those nations. Where are the women of those nations? Where are the oppressed minorities, racial groups of those nations? And secondly, it doesn't really address the problem of domination by big countries of small countries in the world, because mostly what you're getting is proposals to bring the other big countries onto the Security Council, which I think doesn't really, it just says that we have more big countries who dominate other people in their regions that want to be in the same power as the Western big countries, and China and Russia. For India, for example, India is clearly a major world power, as is Brazil, Nigeria. These are countries that people talk about needing to have on the Security Council more. But each one of them is also an oppressor and an imperialist within their own regions. And so if you're talking about the problem of domination of the world by big countries, yes, probably you need to bring in the ones that aren't just Western. And at the same time, these proposals don't really challenge that domination from my point of view.
We're talking on this edition of Common Ground with Dr. Charlotte Bunch, director of the Center for Women's Leadership at Rutgers University. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
One of the big ironies that we face right now as a women's movement is that the people who are opposed to human rights and democracy have taken women more seriously than many of the people who we would see as our natural allies. And by that I mean the Vatican, I think, takes the women's movement very seriously and has seen that it has to organize against it because it recognizes that the empowerment of women and the move to get women human rights in the family is very central to the process of trying to expand the concept of democracy overall and expanding the acceptance of human rights. And too many of the defenders of human rights haven't seen how central the question of women is to the question of democracy and authoritarianism and what I think is a sort of major worldwide struggle between these tendencies in our current time.
Another diversity question. At this series of UN conferences we've been talking about, from the Children's Summit to Vienna, Rio, Cairo, Copenhagen, and now on to Beijing, we've seen this rise of the participation, at least of the non-governmental organizations. And nearly everyone applauds this as a way of getting certainly more grassroots involvement in international policymaking. But what I've noticed, and I'm sure you have also, is that the NGOs that are the real players are the ones with money, mostly based in the Western world, and largely dominated by men. What can be done about that?
Well, I think that's a real challenge for the NGO community. I think that it's absolutely true that to do this work in the UN, you have to have money and you have to be very committed to sort of following what is sometimes viewed by the outside as sort of esoteric questions. Even an organization like my own, we feel constantly in conflict between the work we want to do in leadership training with women at the local and regional level and the amount of energy we want to put into monitoring the UN at the international level. The solution that we've tried to come up with for the future is that we want to spend more time after this round of world conferences in the training of women at the local and the regional level and how they can monitor the UN from their own countries and how they can more effectively monitor their government's participation in the UN. But that's a real question, I think, that all of us who consider ourselves UN NGOs working to influence the UN need to look at, because you can become very involved in doing the work with the UN and a specialist in that, and really, I think, lose track of the local and regional movements that you've come from, because the UN requires a certain kind of concentration. So I think each of our movements, and I think this is true with the women's groups as well as with the male-dominated NGOs, really need to make a commitment to diversifying the access we provide, i.e., if we have access to the UN, we need to figure out ways to create greater access for others that are the diversity of our own issue and our own perspective. And I think the male NGOs, male-dominated NGOs in human rights and development in those areas need to make a much stronger commitment to bringing the voices of women as well as of racial minorities and various other groups into the space that they have access to through their resources.
Do you see evidence of that happening? Are you optimistic, I should say, I guess?
Well, I see moments of it happening. I should say that, I mean, I'm optimistic that if enough pressure is put on NGOs and if NGOs recognize that their credibility really depends on doing this, that some will do it. And hopefully those who do it will find that it is satisfying and works and is important and will encourage them more. But probably it will also happen because certainly in the women's movement we get criticized all the time by the local grassroots groups if we don't do it. So hopefully there's a certain accountability that each of us will feel to our grassroots and there's a process that needs to be worked out there. But it's a problem. I think it's a very real issue.
At the Copenhagen conference, women were very visible because they staged a hunger strike in the middle of the main lobby of the official conference site. So maybe it doesn't take money as much as it takes some creativity, perhaps.
Right. Well, I think there are two different kinds of influence. I think that the influence that the World Conferences allow for of a particular historic moment of being able to do a creative action that dramatizes the issue, much as we did in Vienna with the tribunal, or women have done with the hunger strikes, or women in Vienna from Bosnia, I remember at the World Conference on Human Rights, laid their bodies across the entrance of the door one day. I mean, so I think that those moments of creativity only really work if, one, there is a sense of the legitimacy of the issue that's being done with, and two, if there's also some background work being done by others to follow that up. So there's different types of influence, but I think the creativity moments are very important to take, but that the real ongoing problem, and this is what women are facing from the work we've done, much of which was more in the creativity consciousness-raising mode in the beginning, what we're now seeing with, say, the Human Rights Commission is, yes, we were creative at the World Conference and they put these things on the agenda, but now if we want to get those things implemented, we have to be there watching them at every meeting, questioning them, showing them how and what it is we think it means to do this, and that takes a lot of time and energy, and it takes money to have staffing to do that.
On another area, there was a Ms. Magazine article last year titled, "Who's Watching the Peacekeepers?" And it was about sexual harassment, exploitation, and abuse perpetrated against women by UN peacekeeping forces in the field. Do you have any thoughts on what can be done about that?
Yes. One of the recommendations that we made in Vienna, and that falls into this category of unmet but stated commitments, is that there needs to be gender conscious human rights training for all UN peacekeepers and all military forces around the world on the human rights of women and the necessity to respect those as representatives, particularly of UN peacekeeping, but also of military forces in general. Obviously, that training won't do everything, but I think that if there was that kind of systematic training of the personnel who are involved in peacekeeping, that this was considered by the UN or by their government as a fundamental human rights issue, and they would be held accountable for violating it, which is why the tribunals right now around Bosnia are so important, because there's the attempt for the first time at the international level to say military forces should be held accountable for war crimes generally, which include rape done in the name of war. But if governments and the UN said, these are the human rights of women, as peacekeepers, you will be held accountable for violating these, and really did so, I think it would diminish. Probably wouldn't eliminate the problem entirely, but I think it would diminish it quite significantly.
Beyond the training, should we require more diversity among the peacekeepers themselves?
Well, that would be an excellent idea as well, and I think that would be very useful. To require diversity among them, to require training, and to enforce regulations prohibiting these things.
There's also sexual harassment cases involving male officials at UN headquarters. I don't mean to make light of it, but maybe we could use some gender-conscious human rights training at UN headquarters as well.
We could.
The difficult thing there is that many of the people there have diplomatic immunity. It's very hard to press cases against them. And the UN does a pretty good job of covering these things up, of making sure that they're not publicized. Do you have any thoughts on this process and what we can do here?
Well, I think this is a major issue, because I think it is very related. I think that the UN's credibility in trying to tell peacekeeping forces that they shouldn't violate women is totally undermined when the headquarters of the UN is allowing that same violation to occur within its midst. So I don't think it's a minor issue at all. I think you're absolutely right that there has to be a systematic respect of these human rights across the board. And first of all, women have to demand that. Secondly, men have to stop covering up for other men and stop letting it go unnoticed, which is the kind of male bonding that goes on at the UN now, which is primarily men not taking seriously what they see other men doing. And I think they have to start calling each other on it informally first, and then through formal procedures if it doesn't change. And I think that has to be a commitment that NGOs demand of the United Nations.
Is reform possible, or should we consider it a failed institution, that we should move on to some successor institution now?
Well, I don't know how much reform is possible, but I think at this moment the United Nations is the global policy arena that we have. And I think that not enough effort has yet been made to push for the kinds of reforms that many of us want to see. I think this is a very good time for groups who want to see it reformed to push very hard, because with the end of the Cold War, there's a lot of uncertainty about how the United Nations should move forward. So I think it's the best time we've ever had to attempt to get some reform there. I'm not sure that the United Nations is the body we would ultimately want, and maybe through the process of trying to change it, we'll get better ideas and create something new, or some new parts of it will emerge that will be even better. But I think that only comes right now through really working to push this institution that we have here.
All right. In closing, at the Social Summit in Copenhagen earlier this year, Bella Abzug said something about the feminization of poverty that I thought was really interesting and could be applied to so many things. I just wanted your reaction to it. She said, quote, "Women were not involved in the process which created this mess, but we're going to clean it up. I'm optimistic. I've always believed women will change the nature of power," unquote.
Well, I certainly am optimistic that bringing women who have been excluded from the process in will help us see the way to some new solutions, including some re-examining of power and some greater accountability of power. I think that I've seen enough women be corrupt in power that I don't want to imply that there's any biological connection between issues of power and corruption. I think that basically those who have power tend to get corrupt unless there's enough mechanisms and pressure on them not to, and that therefore we need to create a system that doesn't exclude so much, so many people, and that keeps those mechanisms of accountability in place. And I don't know. I think women are in a very good position to move that process another step forward. And maybe that changes the nature of power. I'm not quite sure. But at least empowerment of more people and a less concentration of power and a more accountable power is something I would work for.
That is Dr. Charlotte Bunch, director of the Center for Women's Leadership at Rutgers University. For Common Ground, I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9528, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9528. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. By B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.